everybody,
and welcome to this next session, which is a specially extended session on a very hot topic at the moment on EU GDPR. We're going to start with a presentation and then go into a panel discussion. As for the other keynote sessions, we do have microphones, but you can also use Slido if you want to post your questions, and they'll appear on the screen for the panel. So you've got two choices when it comes to the Q&A element of the session. So this session, as I say, is on EU GDPR. And we've got a panel which is going to be led by Brian Honan. Brian here will be taking over after I've introduced our first speaker. And our speaker is Peter Brown from the Information Commissioner's Office, who's going to give you a little presentation on where your organisation should be now in its preparation for EU GDPR. So without hesitation, I will hand over to Peter. Thank you.
Oh, no. Thank you very much, everybody. And it's good to see so many people here to see where their organisation is in terms of GDPR at the moment. And thank you also to the organisers for asking me to come and talk here today. So for those who don't know, and I'm hoping most people do know who we are, but just in case you don't, we are the UK's independent authority set up to uphold information rights in the public interest. We promote openness by public bodies and privacy for individuals, and we regulate a number of different pieces of legislation in both fields. And obviously here today, we're here to talk about the one on the right there, GDPR. And I'm sure it's escaped no one's notice that we are just a few days past the halfway point in GDPR implementation. GDPR has been in force just over a year. A lot of people are sometimes surprised to know that it is actually in force now, has been in force already for just over a year. Implementation date is next May, the 25th, and there we are, just past halfway. I will have to preface the rest of this talk with two minor points. Some people are possibly aware that there is a proposal to update the e-privacy directive, which is where we get the privacy and electronic communications from. That is a draft version from the Commission at the moment, and it's about to go through what they call the trilogue process between the various EU institutions. So I hope there won't be too many questions on e-privacy as relates to data protection at the moment, because we only have that draft to go on. We don't know what the final version is going to say. And I will also add that there may be some questions on some people's minds about post-Brexit data protection frameworks, but there's one day to go to an election. We are under PERDA at the ICO, so I can't really comment too much on that, and I hope I won't disappoint too many people by saying so. So, on to GDPR and benchmarking and where you should be now. I mean, GDPR is part of the response to the challenges of upholding information rights in a digital age, when you have increasing technological innovations everywhere in the world, and the explosion in data that's being produced from, you know, think of all the devices you now have on your person, not just in your home, an environment of rapid technological change. But it's important to note, I think, that GDPR is more of an evolution than a revolution. And we can see this if we compare the data protection principles. I'm hoping most people in the room will know what those are. The 8 principles of good practice in the Data Protection Act. And I'd say, I hope we all know them word for word. But it's possibly more useful to compare GDPR with the Data Protection Directive on which the Data Protection Act is based. And the Data Protection Directive is slightly different. The principles there are called principles relating to data quality, and you have 5 of them. And you can directly map those to the principles in the DPA. It's not that difficult. They're pretty much identical. But if you keep those in mind, and then we move over to GDPR, they're called principles relating to the processing of personal data. And you have basically the same stuff, just taken a step further, with 2 main additions. One being that there is a security and confidentiality principle, when there wasn't before. Our principle 7 in the Data Protection Act comes from Article 17 of the directive. And there is also a big one at the bottom, the accountability principle. Data controllers must be able to demonstrate compliance with the rest of those principles. But many of the same things are still there from Data Protection Directive through to DPA, through to the GDPR. It's just one of those things where it's moved forward. If you look at the first principle, we say now personal data must be processed fairly and lawfully. That's principle one DPA. In GDPR, it's exactly the same except "and transparently" is added, or "in a transparent manner," I think is the actual wording. And as with the directive, chapters on subject rights and international transfers are elsewhere in the text. It's exactly the same, basically, just moved a step forward a little bit. So how should you approach implementing measures to comply with GDPR? It should be noted, it's an issue for board level, whatever the size of your business. I mean, one strategy that you could adopt is the carrot and stick strategy, and that is a Creative Commons picture, if anyone was wondering. I'll show you in a moment that we are prepared to use the stick if we need to, but the carrot might actually be more effective. So let's not forget the risks. You're processing personal data frequently. You have to keep material confidential. If you don't adhere to good data protection practices, you run the risk of things like enforcement action and from us and reputational damage from everyone else. These would obviously be the two main risks that you could take to key decision makers in your organization if you're still on that point where you think, do we need to do anything? I mean, if I just quickly run through the last 12 months of our enforcement action, we've issued 52 monetary penalties, totaling just under £4 million in that time. And they're roughly split between DPA and PECA, half and half, Privacy and Electronic Communications Regulations. And those include our largest DPA fine to date, £400,000. We've also issued 18 enforcement notices, we issued 17 undertakings, and we're engaged in 18 prosecutions in that time. If we look at what GDPR says, and I'm sure everyone's seen Article 58 of GDPR, powers of the supervisory authority. We have a number of powers that are more wide-ranging than under the DPA. Investigative powers, corrective powers, authorization and advisory powers. And we also have the big one, the administrative fines. But it's important to note out that administrative fines are one aspect of the powers that the supervisory authority has. Yes, there are two tiers. There's 2% for certain infringements of some provisions, Articles 25 to 39, for example. And then there's 4% for infringing the actual principles of GDPR itself. And I've seen quite a few news reports over the last sort of year or so comparing, whenever we issue a fine to someone, someone has the tendency to compare it to what we would have issued in 12 months' time. I mean, all I can say on that one is that as part of our recently published Information Rights Strategic Plan, we say that we'll be laying down a new regulatory action policy in the near future, I think sometime next year. So again, I can't really say too much on what would be the case after next May, but just watch this space. And I would also point out that our enforcement action will be appropriate and proportionate to the circumstances. But this is just to show that, yes, that's the stick. There is a stick in the cupboard that we could use. And you could take that as a strategy and say, well, this might happen to us if we don't do this. But the carrot might actually be better. If you think of the opportunity that GDPR affords, you can basically get data protection right, earn trust of consumers, and possibly obtain a competitive advantage. It's more like almost not think of the money you may lose in a fine, think of the money you may make if you get things right. And I know that may not apply to every organisation in the room, but if we just look at some stats, for example, and these are from our annual track survey that we've done. I think this is the most recent one last year. So 77% of individuals are concerned organisations not keeping their data secure. Individuals are less likely to take up new services if they do not trust the provider to keep their data safe. We have 20% of individuals in a survey we did for Data Protector Day said they would definitely stop using a company's services after they heard of a data breach. And another 57% said they would consider it. If we take the example of the TalkTalk case, someone said, I think it was roughly 100,000 customers stopped using their services in the wake of that. Now, yes, they're a large communications provider and there's a level of churn involved. But, you know, that's a lot of people. And if you add the 20% and the 57%, you almost get to a potential 80% of customers that could leave your company following hearing of a breach. So businesses that understand the rules and invest in compliance will be in a better position to gain an advantage, to gain trust, and to help the digital economy, if nothing else. I mean, there's another one there about 14% of people think they have control over their data, and GDPR is about putting the individual back in control of their information. But I do want to say, it's not just about fines. I know that gets the press, that gets the headlines all the time. It's an opportunity to do things properly. GDPR is a 21st century piece of legislation. So yeah, don't think just of how much money we're going to lose, how much damage would happen to our reputation. Think of what you could gain if you get it right. So where should you be? This is a difficult question to answer. I suppose that's why you've asked me to come here to talk about it. As we said, GDPR does mark a significant change, but one that's more of an evolution as opposed to a revolution. I know you want clarity, particularly now we're halfway through the implementation period. We get requests when we do outreach at events like these for clear, specific guidance on certain topics. We get people ask us, you know, tell us what to do. We want to do A, B, and C to get X, Y, and Z. But I can say that in certain areas that I'm going to go through in the rest of this presentation, we can give some clarity. But ultimately, the answer to this rather all-encompassing question is it depends. And I appreciate that's not possibly going to go down very well with everyone in the room. But it's the simplest answer to give, because you're all different organizations. You're different sized, you've got different resources, you're doing different things, you have different requirements. And to be brutally honest, and I'm naming no names, and I'm saying probably everyone in this room is accepted, but even today, let's just say the current level of compliance with the DPA is possibly not as good as it could be. So, you know, I can't give one set of answers that will fit absolutely everybody in the room, because it's just not possible. I will say, though, that if you are compliant with good and best practice at the moment, you're in a very good position going forward for when GDPR comes in. You may still have to do certain things. If you, for example, don't have a DPO at the moment, you may need to get one. And we'll look at DPOs in a little while. You should still undertake a review of what you're doing, even if you think you're actually compliant with that best practice at the moment. And what are we doing? Well, as I said, we've been asked all these questions about guidance and specific things. We are producing advice and guidance. We have done already. We were the first DPA in Europe, I think, to actually produce an overview document, a general guidance on the GDPR. We followed that up with 12 steps to take, which I'm going to get to in a moment. We have draft guidance on consent. We have a new privacy notices code of practice come out. We continue also to play a full role at European level in the Article 29 Working Party. And we've contributed to guidance on such things as data portability, data protection impact assessments, data protection officers, lead supervisory authority. Those are all papers recently produced from Article 29 that we've had a role in, and there's more coming both from us and from the Article 29 in the next year. So if you look at that, there's profiling paper coming, there's consent guidance coming, there's breach notification guidance coming. There is a lot of stuff that we are doing, and that that sort of treadmill, you like, of guidance is going to keep coming. Just out of interest, who here has actually gone through the 12 steps? So a few. So this is good. So the next few slides won't be lost on everybody. That's good. The 12 steps, I should state up front, these are not 12 steps to compliance. I'm sure everyone would like them to be. It's 12 steps to take to see where you are and see what, if anything, you need to do in time for next May. There was a smattering of hands that went up when I asked that question. One thing I would say, where should you be now? You should be reading that, maybe, and just working through it. And we're not necessarily expecting you to have gone through everything from top to bottom and started implementing all the changes, or even have got to the end of that process. But it's something that you can look at and sort of give yourself a snapshot where we are now with our compliance, what we've got to do over the next 12 months. So these are the steps themselves. These are the first six. And we'll be going through a few of these in a little more detail now. But we recognise that if you look at the second one, for example, it says information you hold. And when you look at the 12 steps guidance, it talks about possibly doing an information audit. So you can see what personal data you've got, where you got it from, all that sort of thing. And that's going to be extremely important because it all feeds into the accountability principle. You've got to be able to demonstrate how you're complying with GDPR. And here are the other 12, the other part of the 12 steps. And the top one we will look at in a moment there, consent. It might be a daunting task to go through this, particularly just the information audit by itself could be a daunting thing to go through, but it's worth doing just to see where you are. And if we look at a few of these topics in a bit more detail, so communicating privacy information. Last October, we published a new code of practice on privacy notices, transparency and control. It covers a variety of topics, such as what should be provided to individuals, when that information should be provided, where it should be provided, how you should go about writing a privacy notice, particularly in the context of GDPR, because the legislation is clear. It says it should be in a clear, accessible language. It should be easy to read, easy to understand. But transparency, ultimately, is just about being clear with individuals what it is you're doing with their information, telling people what you're doing and why. Goes hand in hand with security, which is doing it properly. So you just think, for example, if you're a maker of, say, a connected device of some sort, an Internet of Things device, it might be some sort of sleek, minimalist, sort of black cube of some sort that sits on a shelf and does, I'm sure, very amazing things with all sorts of personal information from the users who've bought that device. But think, how are you going to communicate privacy information, fair processing information, to users of that device? There's no screen for them to read. You're going to put it in the manual, maybe? Well, no one reads the manual, do they? You just put it on the shelf and turn it on. These are all things to consider, and the guide, or the code of practice, does go through some examples of that. But it must be concise, it must be transparent, it must be intelligible, it must be easily accessible. So one thing you could be doing is reviewing your privacy notices and seeing if they meet the standard required by GDPR. And the code of practice is there to help you do that. Now, if we look at individuals' rights, GDPR rights are substantially similar to what the current data subject rights are. They're just taking on a little bit further. So if you look at things like data portability and right to be forgotten, those are two new things. So what you should be doing, you're all data controllers already, so you should have procedures in place to do things like subject access, for example. All you need to know about GDPR subject access is it's not 40 days anymore, it's within a month, and there's no fee except in exceptional circumstances. It's not going to require a massive change to procedure in order to comply with that element of it. But if we look at right to be forgotten and we look at right of data portability, these are different things, these are new things that enhance pre-existing rights in different ways. So if we think of right to be forgotten, we get a lot of questions about right to be forgotten, Article 17. But it's important to note the right to be forgotten is not absolute, it's qualified. There's elements in 17.3 that may mean you don't have to accede to a right to be forgotten request where the processing is being undertaken with in compliance with a legal obligation, 17.3b. There you go. And a lot of people think that this right to erasure is absolutely fundamental and absolute, isn't it? It's very qualified. But if we look a little bit more in depth at data portability, which is another one we get asked about, we recommend reading the guidelines produced by the Article 29 Working Party, which were recently revised and adopted at the start of April. And it covers basically everything you want to know about data portability, but we're always afraid to ask. So we have main elements. What is data portability? We have when that right applies. We have the rules around it and how the rules around data subject rights apply. How the data must be provided. The regulation speaks of commonly used machine-readable formats, preferably interoperable, but it doesn't place any requirement on data controllers to develop interoperable formats just to fulfill data portability requirements. But importantly, I recommend reading that part of the guidance quite clearly. It should be it's data provided knowingly and actively by the data subject as well as personal data generated by the use of a service. So, for example, it says, observe data provided by the data subject by virtue of the use of the service or device. So things like search history, traffic data, location data could fall into scope of a portability request, but it doesn't include inferred data and derived data that the data controller may create by themselves. And it finally says, provided by the data subject should be interpreted broadly. So if you haven't looked at that, have a look at that and see how that applies to your organization in your implementation. Now we come to a big one. This is another one we get asked about a lot. Consent under GDPR. Basically, you need to do these things. Review how you seek, manage, and record consent now. Consider whether you need to make any changes in accordance with what GDPR says about consent. And then you may, it doesn't say you do, but you may need to refresh your existing consents if they don't meet the requirements of GDPR. That's very basically what the 12 steps say. But we need to go into a little more detail to see what that means. So if we look at the definition of consent, you won't find this in the DPA because it comes from the directive. On the left is what the directive says. So this is the definition of consent from the Data Protection Directive. Freely given, specific and informed indication of wishes by which data subject signifies his agreement. GDPR, as you can see, the box is a bit bigger because there are more words. Here we go. Very similar. Oh, there's a new bit there. And it's still very similar. And, oh, there's a new bit there as well. So we have two new parts of the consent definition. Freely given, specific, informed, and unambiguous. Indication of the data subject wishes by a statement or clear affirmative action. So that is one of the examples of how things move forward. But in reality, that definition merely reflects interpretation and case law that have evolved since the directive came about in 1995. One clear example is the Article 29 opinion on consent that was published in 2011, which contains substantially the same sort of things in it. But what it does mean is that under GDPR, there is a greater emphasis on consent and individuals having clear, granular choices up front, and ongoing control over that consent. And I should just note out that we're talking about consent as a basis for processing. We're not talking about consent in, you know, PECA terms, e-privacy terms, although it relates to this. This is consent as the lawful basis for processing. I should say, again, contrary to what you might read, GDPR does not require all processing of personal data to be done on consent basis. Like the DPA, consent is one of a number of lawful, what they call lawful bases for processing. If you're more familiar with DPA, it would be your conditions for processing in Schedule 2 and 3. It's one of them, and it may not always be the one that applies the most. And just because it is first on the list when you look at Article 6, but that doesn't mean it's the most important of the six. It doesn't mean you should consider it first. That's all that needs to be noted on that one. But where you have chosen consent as the lawful basis, or where consent could only be the lawful basis for processing, then it should be compliant with GDPR. So you should be reviewing how that consent is sought. You should be deciding whether you need to make changes. You should be refreshing existing consents. If your consents that you've got now are valid for GDPR, then that's great. If they're not, you may need to refresh. Consent won't be valid if it's inferred from silence, pre-tick boxes, or inactivity, if it's not separate from terms and conditions, and if there's no way for an individual to withdraw that consent. Earlier this year, we published the first piece of specific granular guidance that was requested, which was the draft guidance on consent. And it was opened out for a consultation period, which ended at the end of March, I think. And it basically summarizes what GDPR says about consent, what those implications are. It underlines the changes. It specifies how a clear affirmative act is required, how consent should be separate from other terms and conditions, how clear records must be kept, how the consent, you know, what is the meaning of freely given, specific, informed, and unambiguous. It goes through all that stuff. It goes to how you record the consents. Those are basically the questions it asks when you read through the document. And there's a checklist at the end, which may be helpful for some organizations in the room. And Article 29 is also due to publish some further guidance on consent later in the year. So that's consent. It doesn't have to be required for all processing of personal data on GDPR. It's one of several lawful bases. If you are relying on it, then you do need to have a look at how you're recording consent at the moment. Another one we get asked about is breach notification, which is effectively, who do I tell and when? If we look again at, you're probably all data controllers now. You might have, depending on the industry and sector you work in, some of you might have established organizational policy that you will report data breaches to the ICO. Some of you may not, but you need to check to see if you have your procedures in place to detect, report, and investigate a personal data breach. As I say, some organizations have mandatory requirements now. Some may have requirements under privacy and electronic communications regulations. That's a 24-hour breach reporting requirement. But under GDPR, it gets extended. And it's worth looking at, or just to point out, by the way, I forgot that one at the bottom, failure to report can result in a fine as well as the breach itself. So that's why it becomes important. But again, if we look at what the regulation says, you have to tell us when, or unless, rather, the breach is unlikely to result in risk. But if it is likely to result in risk, then you have to tell us without undue delay and where feasible within 72 hours of becoming aware of it. You have to tell the data subject in cases where the personal data breach is likely to result in a high risk. So the two definitions are not quite the same, and that can be a little confusing to work through. But it's basically, if you read through it, it's like tell us most of the time. If it becomes extremely serious, very high risk, tell the data subjects as well. And you have to do that without undue delay. You get no timescale for this one. But we much prefer to receive the report that something's happened, even if you don't yet know the full extent of what's happened, than we do to find out 2 weeks after you give us a full report. You say, oh, well, this happened 3 weeks ago. It's like, well, no, you just tell us. We accept ongoing updates, that's fine. But the important thing is just to tell us what's going on. We've got current guidance out already for organizations that don't report at the moment or don't have any policies and procedures in place. You could go away and look at the current guidance we have on security breach management, notification of data security breaches. And if you want to read the PECA one as well, you can read the PECA one. There is more Article 29 guidance on breach notification coming out soon. But it's also important to note that if you're operating in a sector that may be covered by other, particularly European directives, has anyone heard of the NIS directive? I imagine most people have heard of the NIS directive. That has breach notification reporting in it. Has anyone heard of EIDAS? Yeah, that has breach. that has notification reports in it as well. So you may also already be subject to a notification regime of some sort. So that's something to take away, something to think about. DPIAs. Who here does privacy impact assessments? Okay, very good. Under the GDPR, they're known as data protection impact assessments, and it effectively means that they become mandatory in certain circumstances. So, I mean, the phrases privacy by design and privacy impact assessment in GDPR become data protection by design and by default and data protection impact assessments. And basically, they become a legal requirement. We consider them already to be best practice. And often an organization will get in touch with and ask to talk about something they're doing or something they're proposing to do, and we'll always say, show us the PIA. But they're mandatory in certain circumstances under the GDPR. A DPIA is a very useful tool for an organization to map the information flows that's going around a prospective data processing operation. So what you should be doing is assessing where it's necessary to carry out a DPIA, as well as who's going to do it and what else is needed. But again, we have guidelines from Article 29 on DPIAs. This is out, I think the commenting period on this one has just finished. But it goes through a number of things. What they're supposed to address, what would be subject to a DPIA, how they should be carried out, when you should consult the supervisory authority. It gives you examples of existing frameworks. That includes one of our codes, which we'll show you in a minute. It also talks about processing that's currently underway, so processing you're doing now. And the general recommendation there is that for processing operations already underway today, there should be a DPA done at some point in the near future, or if there's a specific change of purpose or new technology involved. But like with PIAs, they should be a living document. It shouldn't just be done and filed away and forgotten about. So that's another thing to go away and have a look at if you haven't looked at it already. And as I said, there may be a slightly revised version of it coming out later in the year, but that's out now, that preliminary version. And those are criteria that the opinion contains for determining when a processing operation may be likely to result in high risk. It's technically for the DPAs to come up with their own list, because Article 35.4 requires us to do that. But there's no reason why you can't go and look at that list of criteria and see how many apply to whatever processing you're going to do. The general rule of thumb is the more that apply, the more likely it is to be a high-risk processing operation, and therefore more likely to require a data protection impact assessment. Prior consultation, that is defined in the guidelines. So 36.1 says you must consult the supervisory authority in certain circumstances, and the guidelines interpret that as when there's residual risk. So you've done a DPIA, you've identified a risk, you've got a number of measures to try and bring that risk down to an acceptable level, and you can't quite bring it down appropriately, then you consult the supervisory authority, the ICO, basically. And we have currently a PIA code of practice, which I hope some people are familiar with, and it goes through everything you need to do, pretty much. I think one final one before we get onto some toolkits. Data protection officers. Who here has got one? Who here is one? There was a few. Excellent. Hello at the back. So, data protection officers, that's part of the 12 steps. Basically, you have to consider whether you are obligated to designate one. There are three circumstances in the regulation where you have to do one: public body, except court, acting in its judicial capacity, where your core activities include systematic monitoring on a large scale, where your core activities include large-scale processing of special category data. That's sensitive personal data is the equivalent. It's called special category data in GDPR. And then you need to assess where that role is going to sit within your organization. Now, we can kind of go so far as to tell you how to do that, but ultimately it comes down to your own decision, your own organization, your own circumstances. Article 38 just says it shall directly report to the highest management level. But we have guidelines, DPOs as well. And helpfully, they also define, or should I say interpret, things like large scale, systematic monitoring, core activities. That's all in there as well. But it covers these things. So again, that's another piece of guidance from Article 29 that the ICO have inputted on, that you can go and have a look at. Should I appoint one? Well, we just said that. Public authority, core activities, regular systematic monitoring, special categories. DPOs, importantly, also have a role to play in doing data protection impact assessments. I must address this one. I don't know how many people have seen this in many news reports. There's an SME exemption, isn't there, to appointing a data protection officer? No, there isn't. There is a general derogation in the GDPR for SMEs, but it applies for records of processing activities, Article 30. And that doesn't apply where processing is likely to result in a risk, it's not occasional, or it includes special category data. So there is a derogation, but it's from record keeping. It's nothing to do with DPOs. That was in an original draft of the GDPR from 5 years ago. The final version does not have an exemption for SMEs for appointing DPOs. If they need to appoint one, they need to appoint one. So that's a very quick run through of some of the elements of the 12 steps. But we also have some toolkits that can help you out. We have a freshly enhanced GDPR assessment toolkit, which not surprisingly goes through the 12 steps, not in exactly the same order, but it's something you can go on our website and run through. It gives you more information about each bit. I think it's sort of split into kind of five main areas in which several of the steps are covered. So the first one has awareness and accountability in the information audit side of things. So there's that to go through. What else do we have? Oh yes, this is what it sort of looks like. There are the five areas actually, there we go. And you end up with a rating on the left. You get an overall rating that says green. That one's very good. And gives you suggestions for things to look at to improve where you need to. So again, if you haven't done the toolkit, that's one thing to go away and have a look at and go through our toolkit. There's an information security conference, and I can't not mention security. It's what I do. I'm a senior technology officer. We provide advice and guidance to the office on technology, for example, and cybersecurity. I have to mention it. And really, if you think about it, it's the 13th of the 12 steps, security of processing. If you compare and contrast, we've done this a few times with the directive and the GDPR. Here's what the directive says as a principle about security. It doesn't say anything. Article 17 has got what we now transposed as Principle 7. So it's not that the directive doesn't say anything about security. It does. It just doesn't say it as a principle. It's got it as Article 17. GDPR does have the security and confidentiality principle. That's the full one. I gave a very short version of it on the prior slide. But if you look at the wording, unauthorized processing, accidental loss, destruction or damage, appropriate technical organizational measures, this is a phrase that we should all know very well. It's not difficult. But I should say, what does compliance look like today? What do we look for? We look for things like, in the information security aspect, we look for things like knowledge of assets, a secure baseline, proactive protection, monitoring, user training, organizational policies, disaster recovery. Those are the things we look at from our perspective when we're getting these breach reports coming in and there's a cybersecurity angle to it. But you probably want to know what compliance looks like under GDPR. Well, Article 32 is the article you want to look at. That's the one that goes through in more detail what security of processing requires. And it brings in, like the rest of GDPR, what is current and best practice to a legal minimum. So we're all familiar with the CIA triad, I hope, in this room. That now comes in as a legal minimum, effectively. Resilience is there as well, resilience of services, the ability to restore availability and access to personal data, and importantly, processes for regularly testing, assessing and evaluating the effectiveness of the measures. So it takes all that stuff we've just said, what we look for today, one stage further on. And the biggest problem is going to be those businesses where they may recognize that they have work to do in this area, but they haven't actually done anything about it yet. And that's the problem we're going to have. I mean, and I should also say Article 32 directly mentions two technical measures, pseudonymization and encryption, which the directive and the DPA don't mention. It doesn't say what standard of encryption you should use. It doesn't tell you what algorithm you should use. It doesn't tell you where you should use it. It just says encryption. So that's something else to take away. And we have an information security assessment that you could undertake if you haven't done so already. And a lot of the concepts in information security are not that different from DPA to GDPR because information security is not necessarily data protection. The concepts travel over very well. It covers four main areas. I think, you know, we all know this: physical security, staff and awareness, management, network security, again, provides an overall rating. So that's our two assessments you could do. You could read a wodge of this stuff as well. This is our extra guidance on various specific areas: encryption, Wi-Fi location, privacy, mobile apps, research into big data. I particularly recommend the middle one, learning from the mistakes of others, because although it's 3 years old, if you're operating online services, the same mistakes are being made. We're still seeing SQL injection attacks and so on and so forth. So conclusions, basically, you should be busy if you're not already, and I hope you all are. Working through the 12 steps, planning, implementing any necessary changes, going through the toolkits, trying to use the carrot and stick approach if you need to get buy-in from the top, and reviewing relevant guidance from the ICO and Article 29. And basically, that's where you should be right now. So thank you very much. And I think we're doing a panel. Thank you. I've got to try and get into the middle. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Peter. And I think it's a very useful whistle-stop tour through GDPR and what's going to mean to organizations. And I think the fact that so many people here shows and demonstrates what a big issue GDPR is.
Yeah.
And, I've been known to comment that in 2017, GDPR in 2017 is what Y2K was in 1999. We seem to have everybody and their granny seems to be experts on GDPR, and there's advice and toolkits and solutions coming out of the woodwork to help us get there. But, you know, we do have a great panel. We've got Helen, Cameron, Peter, and Steve here, who amongst them have a wealth and dearth of knowledge in GDPR. So it's going to be an opportunity for us as a group to get some real advice on GDPR, and not, you know, there's the phrase the GDPR bandwagon, but I wasn't going to use that because there's a GDPR bus outside yesterday. So it's
it was there today as well.
It was there today
when I came in, yes.
So I'm going to give Peter a few minutes to relax and catch his breath. But maybe, Helen, we'll just start with you, maybe just to introduce yourself. And the question put into the panel is, what are the main challenges you're seeing in organizations now in trying to implement and become compliant if they're not already with the GDPR?
So first of all, I'm softly spoken. Can everybody hear me? Okay, lots of nods. That's positive. I can't speak for other organizations. I can speak for ours and say that the challenges vary. I mean, we've so far, the 12 points, 13 in my case, the 12 points in particular we used as our initial baseline back in early 2016 to get ourselves to a state of readiness. We've done our data audit, our health check, so to speak, on our data, where it sits, the risk assessments associated with those data sets, and in particular, I'd say a big challenge around the third-party elements of that. For Costa, it's about our customer data. That's our critical asset at this point. We, of course, have the employee data, but that's held at our corporate enterprise level, and they're dealing with that. But from my side, the customer data, we have 5.5 active million users. That's a lot of customer data that we need to take care of. So what we've done is identified where that data sits. The majority of it sits with third parties. We've had to assess those third parties. And disappointingly and surprisingly, we've also had to educate them on GDPR. There's a lot of assumption out there for processes. A lot of things have been taken for granted in the past. We're having to fix those legacy relationships. In some cases, that means that some of our processes can no longer be retained. And I don't know if that will apply to many of you, but you'll probably find that you will have to respond with alternative solutions if you find that your processes cannot meet your minimum requirements for the GDPR compliance. We're not owning their work. We're going out and saying to them, this is our requirement. Mm-hmm. This is a minimum level of compliance. We require an assurance. If you can't meet that, we need to know.
Okay.
So I'd say right now, third parties.
And Cameron, from your experience, what are the main challenges you're seeing?
Thanks very much, and good afternoon, everybody. For my experiences, I'm a lawyer. I was working, I mean, we've been talking about this since 2011. There's a huge amount of interest in this now, of course, which is evidenced by the number of you in the room today, which is great. But we've been gnashing teeth over the meaning of the GDPR since it was first published in 2011. And I completely echo Peter's comments that there are large areas of it which are the same as the existing law. Unfortunately, you know, rather than having a nice sort of, you know, delta view or black line showing these are the changes, it's written largely in different language. So we've been working out what's actually different. And I think that's one of the challenges that that we've had. And just as a sort of slight sidebar, back in 2011, when I was a private practice lawyer working at DLA Piper, I thought, oh, great, all these interesting angles that we can explore and you know, sell our services, whereas now I'm in-house at HSBC, it's much more trying to make it simple, you know, what do we have to do, which hopefully I can share some of our approaches with you. But I think just as well, one of the challenges that we've got in the financial services sector is that, and I'm sure Peter and the panel will agree, that whenever this was going through the negotiations through the European Commission and all the discussions were around online services like the Facebooks and Google, and I think the European Commission very much had that type of data use in its crosshairs whenever it was developing this. And so to try and get into that conversation, the requirements of other sectors like the financial services sector was quite difficult actually. Because, you know, it may be okay to have a consent-based system for that type of processing. but financial services, where there's a huge amount we need to do without consent to monitor financial crime, etc. Just getting the reassurances that we can continue doing that has been quite a challenge, and we've had, you know, lots of engagement from regulators and to try and get that type of reassurance. But I think one of the challenges we've got is trying to map the requirements onto what we do, really. That's okay. Our immediate comment.
And Stephen, still giving Peter a bit of a chance to catch up. What have you seen?
I think broadly speaking, I think I'm going to, you know, just touch on the point about interpretation, because a lot of the early draft of the text, and still now, can be interpreted in a certain way. Yes. And the hard bit about this, like, you know, I have 20 odd years in security, and when you've got a set of requirements like BS 7799, ISO 27, or PCI, that was straightforward. It was fairly binary, with a level of sort of risk, just to give that appropriate response. But I think the interpretation has been the biggest challenge, and I've had the pleasure of working with some fantastic lawyers, but even the lawyers have been struggling to give us a true interpretation of this. So we've taken it upon ourselves to start working through what the implications and the interpretations mean for John Lewis, in lieu of any guidance from the ISO or other organisations. I think the second major challenge is around the complexity of legacy systems. For us, we've been around 100 years. We've got terabytes of data. We've got umpteen systems and applications. And I think that added against the backdrop of not being a regulated environment. You know, we're a retailer. This is, you know, fundamentally a big sea change for us. And then I think the third challenge is around culture, because really, in my humble opinion, I've been working with this for the last 4 or 5 years now, in my humble opinion, this is all about accountability. Yeah. And really, you could summarize this by saying, if we all had good data management, data governance structures in place, and we were operating within that framework, then GDPR technically would be quite easy to apply, but unfortunately we don't. And so I think that's why it's such a struggle.
Yeah. And Peter, any thoughts or comments or challenges you're seeing from the regulator's point of view of companies coming to you?
As I said in the talk, you know, we are getting lots of requests for specific pieces of guidance on a whole variety of topics. And, you know, we can produce so much at any one time, if you know what I mean, but we have... It is coming out. More is coming out. More is planned. And again, a lot of the... I understand about the interpretations side of things, and a lot of the work that's done at European level, particularly with Article 29, as it becomes the European Data Protection Board, which is what it becomes under GDPR, provides extra, you know, extra interpretations. Like where we're talking about large-scale processing. What is a large-scale processing operation? That can be pretty important, because it can determine whether you need to do DPIA or something, for example. Whereas that is discussed in Article 29 guidance. It is interpreted, at least, by the Article 29. Okay. And it's the same thing with... Well, I talked about the definition of consent, and I referenced that old opinion from Article 29, 2011. Those elements were in there originally. I think it's an opportunity. That's what I was trying to get at to start with. Yeah, we're not going to bang everyone's door down on the 26th of May and say, give us a check for 4% of your global turnover. But it's an opportunity. Well, that's good. I'll hedge that with saying we're unlikely to. But at the same time, if you look at it as it is the opportunity to put in place that good data protection practice throughout organisations, and the organisations that get it right are going to be the ones that gain customer confidence and trust over those that don't or refuse to.
Yeah. One of the challenges I've seen with a number of our clients has been trying to convince the board that the General Data Protection Regulation is a business problem and not something for the IT or the IT security person to worry about.
Yeah.
How would you, as a panel, you know, Cameron, maybe just start with you to address that?
You know, from my perspective, you know, people talk about difficulty getting, you know, executive buy-in, or sometimes think we've got a little bit too much executive buy-in. You know, the data's, you know, for other reasons is really top of the agenda within most banks at the moment. And I think that would be the case even without the GDPR, to be honest, because there's a lot of themes at the moment around about accountability, you know, in the financial services generally, and around about the conduct agenda, looking for fair outcomes for clients, looking beyond, you know, just what's lawful to do with customer data, but what's the right thing to do with customer data. And that is truly getting more embedded in the certainly in our bank at the moment. So I do think there are a lot of positive things. So it's not just the way that we like to think about it. It is, you know, genuinely not just a burden, and it shouldn't be seen that way. It is an opportunity in many ways, both to obviously get customer trust, and also to get, I think, in order to take advantage of the opportunities that are out there in terms of technology with the fintech agenda and other technology opportunities such as cloud. In order to take advantage of those properly, you do need to have good data management and good best practice with data, so that you've got a good awareness of what data you hold, what notices you've provided, what your rights to use that data are, so you can use it in a sort of more sophisticated way, and what you need to be able to do to take advantage of all the opportunities that we've got. And as I say, it really does chime quite well with many of the other things we're doing in the bank around, you know, sensible use of data and the risk frameworks, etc.
I mean, from our perspective in retail, so to Steve's earlier point, we've not been regulated in the past. We've almost had a get-out-of-jail-free card. There's been a level of, you know, if you wish to consult with us in the case of a data breach, we're here, come to us. That's not going to happen anymore. So one of the challenges as well that we experienced was, who owns the GDPR program for us? We have all this customer data. This is not, obviously I'm not as loudly spoken as I'd hoped. So for us, it was about who owns the GDPR program. And that took a lot of coaching and convincing for, you know, our board to also understand this is not an information security program. This is driven by the business. We're here to enable you, and to Peter's earlier point, we're the 13th principle, so to speak. We're going to secure your data, but you own the data. And the majority of GDPR is not around security. There is a lot of business admin to get to grips with. And you need to classify your data and prioritize that data. So, you know, for us, it's who owned it. That took a few months. That wasn't an easy sell, you know. And then it comes down to, again, the point around where does the DPO sit? And it doesn't sit in our organization with security. I mean, I can't speak to others, but for us, that's a conflict of interest. But other companies, if your head of security owns compliance, the DPO sits within you. There's a lot of debate around GDPR ownership.
Stephen, any?
Yeah, I would agree entirely that it is absolutely a business issue. And one of the things that I managed to do quite early on, I've only been at John Lewis 18 months, was to ensure that we had three board directors with responsibility for three different data sets. And only yesterday we were at the Audit and Risk Committee explaining our status on GDPR, but with a data owner there, who's firmly in the business, who has both the marketing directors of John Lewis and Waitrose reports to him. So what we've done is absolutely taken it out of IT. And I did say very early on to the board, stop blaming IT. This is not an IT problem. We've got to drive this accountability from the business. And we've managed to have a great more success, better success, because of that driving through around the ownership. And accountability.
Okay. Peter, any final thoughts on that?
Obviously, I'd agree entirely, as you would expect. But
it's not much fun having a panel agree all the time. You need to have a bit
All I'd say is that, you know, it's been a consistent message that we've tried to get across whenever we speak at events like these. I mean, I've done probably 10 or 12 speaking events over the last year since GDPR was published, and it's been one of the primary things I've said. It's not something for the IT guy in the basement to worry about. It's something for the entire business. And that, I mean, and that's true of everyone from the ICO who goes out. I mean, it's certainly true of our commissioner, Elizabeth Denham. She's made that
you know, a main plank of whenever she goes out to talk to organisations. Well, it's a business issue.
Yeah. But it, but by the same token, we're absolutely dependent on IT. And the same with, you know, I have dual roles of both information security policy and the data privacy. So there's a good healthy conflict of interest there that I need to try to wade through to try and make sure that the security measures that we're putting in place are satisfactory, but at the same time that we're enhancing the rights of our customers, which is our primary focus.
You actually, both yourself and Kate brought the role of the DPO in your answers there, and I think the Data Protection Officer is obviously a key role under GDPR, but the guides we're getting is that the Data Protection Officer has to be somebody senior, reports into the board, can't have a conflict of interest, so can't be head of IT, can't be head of security, can't be head of legal, can't be head of marketing. As somebody who understands legal, understands IT, you know, this is a fantastic person. Where are we going to get this magic one person from, and how are we going to appoint that role? Cameron,
we've deferred it to legal. It's about that interpretation. We just couldn't translate that language, so we've kind of handed it to legal to own. We're going to get on with the pragmatism.
Or just give somebody a different title, not DPO, just Chief of Privacy.
It doesn't have to be. It's a role, not necessarily a title.
Okay, that little get-out clause doesn't work.
I've seen many who are called, say, Chief Compliance Officer or Head of Compliance has the role of the Data Protection Officer.
Okay.
But I was just scooting through the guidelines for, there is a section in the Article 29 guidelines on conflict of interest. I don't know where it is, but it basically does say it shouldn't be like the Chief Financial Officer.
Yeah.
But those are examples that it gives. And as again, we've got examples on this stage where, you know, we've got one organisation where it's completely split off from the InfoSec stuff.
Sorry, another we had a behind the scenes debate on this earlier. It was quite contentious. The ICO has no specific stream of reporting for this, so we kind of thought it was fairly ambiguous, like most of the GDPR.
Just to pull together my thoughts on a few of those points, and in terms of the sort of, as you said, Steve, the need to have a sort of governance framework around it. In many ways, we're lucky in the financial services sector because we're used to massive regulatory change and massive compliance changes. So we've got a sort of big machine, the operational risk framework that we can feed these requirements into. So, in a way, we've hit the ground running with this. But I completely echo as well Steve's point about this is a bit different, and our people are finding it a bit difficult to deal with the fact that the requirements are a bit woolly. You know, you can't just write them down in paper and say, right, you must do this, and put a system in place to do that, because that's a highly sophisticated digital rights management system that we are just not going to get by May 2018. So the difficulty is getting that touchy-feely conversation about, okay, what do we need to do? What can we do? What's right to do? And how can we use the existing technology to get there? So we're finding a challenge as sort of, as we move into execution now, and we've got a good idea of what they need to do. That's one of the biggest challenges I think organizations face. But just on the data protection officer role, I mean, this is another thing that's been debated hotly. Whenever it first came out, the financial services sector with the three lines of defense, 1, 2, 3, with the third being audits, it was a bit more of a, we used to say it's maybe a 2.5. It's in between the advisory piece and the risk steward piece and the order. But the more we looked at it now, it is a bit like a risk steward role. And sorry to talk in three lines of defense sort of language for those of you that aren't familiar with that, but it's a sort of an advisory risk steward role with the audit bit on top. Maybe if you could sort of facilitate that. And we've been speaking to, as you all have probably, law firms on this. Where does it sit? How does the conflict work? And I had a very good answer from a law firm who said, normally it's the people that phone me up and ask me that is actually the person that should be doing it, because they're the person that are worried about how are we going to implement the GDPR and how are we going to advise the company what to do. And I said, maybe I wish I hadn't phoned you up then, because that means it's me. So it's quite an interesting view, the way we've sort of moved a little bit. And if I can make one more point on that. In terms of the independence point, I think that certainly within the rigor of the financial services sector, the lawyers, the legal second line is independent of the business. Do you know what I mean? It's got a different role. So I don't think it could be you know, the head of the head of a business or even the head of IT, which is more of a first line role. But I, you know, our conclusion is that it could be within legal and RC in the second line, regulatory compliance in the second line, because that's independent from the operation of the first line.
I would agree with the second line defence bit. I think just to help my fellow CISO friends,